Welcome, everybody.
My name is Bobby McGill. I'm a reporter for Bloomberg Law. I cover water and public lands primarily. Thanks for coming out at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. I know everyone's still probably pretty tired, but I hope we've got a pretty exciting discussion here for you today. As I'm sure all of you guys know, environmental regulation involves an alphabet soup of environmental laws: National Environmental Policy Act, Federal Lands Policy Management Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and on and on and on. These are all laws and regulations that affect they affect a lot of environmental impacts on the ground, and they probably factor into your coverage as well. And they affect how major projects are built, how oil wells are drilled, whether waterways remain clean, whether drinking water remains drinkable, tribes are consulted and heard, etc. At the same time, environmental and natural resources policy is driven almost as much by litigation as it is by Congress and the public. So, for example, most of us here probably know pretty well that legal action focused on NEPA will shape where and how renewable energy projects are built. If you're following the fight over, say, water to the U.S., which affects development affecting water quality and streams and wetlands, you know that a cascade of lawsuits has resulted in more than half the country being on one rule and less than half the country now being on another rule. If you're following the Colorado River, the water shortage there, you understand that whatever the Bureau of Reclamation does, it's probably going to end up in the court or various courts. So as a journalist, how do you navigate all this? Well, you might want to lawyer up your Rolodex. While the best journalism focuses on what's happening on the ground, lawyers can be essential sources to help you navigate the alphabet soup of environmental regulation and the complication litigation that affects environmental regulation and development nationwide. So we're here today to talk about this and how to develop attorneys as your sources, how they can contribute to your reporting, and maybe most importantly, what policy and legal developments they're watching. So, to my right, actually let's go online first. We have Dylan Hedden Nicely, Director of the Native American Law Program at the University of Idaho. He's joining us online this morning, welcome. Susan Jane Brown at the end of the table. She's the senior attorney at the Western Environmental Law Center in Portland, Oregon. Murray Feldman, he's a partner at Holland & Hart here in Boise. I've asked our panel today to introduce themselves and talk a bit about their legal work, the kinds of environmental litigation that they're following or they're involved in, the most important environmental laws that shape their work. So let's start with Dylan.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for having me, even virtually. Greetings from the still wintry north portion of the state. I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. My family's from Oklahoma, but I was born and raised in Boise, wherever you guys are. So that was where I spent most of my life. I attended law school and earned a master's degree in water resources science and engineering from the University of Idaho, and then went into private practice up here in North Idaho, representing tribes primarily in water rights litigation. So I've managed for most of my career to avoid the alphabet soup, as Bobby put it, and instead focus primarily on issues related to the adjudication of water rights, almost entirely representing tribes, tribal governments, and tribal people. And so I've worked in adjudications in Idaho as well as in Washington State, the Coeur d'Alene Spokane River Basin water rights adjudication, the Clark Fork Ponderay Basin adjudication that just recently came online. And I also work over in Western Washington, representing the Lummi Nation in the nascent Nooksack Basin adjudication. About 7 years ago, I also joined the faculty at the University of Idaho, where I was asked to take up the directorship for the Native American Law Program. And so in that capacity, I spent a lot of time recruiting, mentoring, matriculating, and helping to launch primarily Native American law students, but also law students that are interested in practicing in the field of Native American law. And I've had the opportunity since joining the faculty to spend a lot of time, you know, thinking, studying, and writing about these issues. And primarily what I've focused on has been, no surprise, water rights, particularly for tribes. But a lot of the things that I've thought about have been the intersection between water rights, both at the state and federal level, and the interrelationship of those water rights with climate change, and how climate change might be affecting water policy in the West, and the various things that we could potentially do in order to make our water rights regime more resilient to climate change. More recently, I've also spent a lot of time writing on and thinking about the Supreme Court's treatment of federal Indian law more broadly through cases like McGirt v. Oklahoma, the most recent case, Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta, I should say. Thought a lot about kind of where the Supreme Court is headed and how it is viewing federal Indian law more broadly. So that's kind of what I tend to focus on and what I've spent a lot of time thinking about over the last decade or so. But I come from a family of journalists. My parents started the Boise Weekly right there in Boise, where you guys are at. And so I've had an opportunity to sort of spend a lot of time with journalists over my entire life in a variety of different capacities, both sort of on the inside and on the outside. And so I was really thrilled at the opportunity to participate in this event, because I have so much respect for the job that you all have. And I think that there's a strong interrelationship between the things that we do as lawyers and the things that you guys do as journalists. I think that we both have a unique role in protecting the rule of law in our country. And I believe that the maintenance of the rule of law really depends heavily on public support. But in order for that to actually work, the public has to be informed. I think that both lawyers and journalists have an important role to play in informing the public. But we're experts in different aspects of that responsibility. As lawyers, at least when we're talking about legal issues, lawyers are the subject matter experts. We understand the laws related to, you know, we're talking today about environmental issues, about the laws related to water quality, water quantity, air quality, you name it, endangered species, public lands. But we're trained to communicate with a very particular group of people. We're trained to communicate with judges, other lawyers, and other subject matter experts. We're not particularly well trained to communicate to the public. And I think that's where journalists really come in. Journalists are experts in distilling complex subjects into something that's digestible for the general public. And so I think that it's really that we need each other. We need each other if we're going to adequately fulfill our roles in society. And so I really appreciate the ability or the opportunity to do that when I talk with journalists, and the opportunity to speak with journalists such as yourselves that are interested in learning more about what we do. The last thing I'll say before I hand it off is, Bobby asked me to think a little bit about, you know, some of the things that journalists should keep in mind when they're working with tribes or they're working on tribal issues that also involve things like federal lands, environmental issues, etc. And so I have three things I want to present to you, at least for now, for your consideration. The first thing that I'd like to suggest to you is that every issue, every environmental issue, particularly in the West, involves a tribe, not just on their reservations or environmental issues that involve their reservations, but really throughout the landscape. Tribes, particularly in the West, have a very, very strong relationship that is rooted in thousands of years of occupation throughout the landscape. It wasn't just but a couple of hundred years ago that all of the land that we now use and occupy was owned by indigenous people. And so those relationships didn't suddenly disappear when the land shifted from their ownership to non-Indian ownership. And so the public lands continue to be very important places and uniquely important places for tribal people. And so as you examine these environmental or public lands issues, I hope that you will consider what these issues mean for the people that are indigenous to those specific places. The other thing I think that is important to keep in mind is that tribes have distinct interests in these cases. A lot of times people tend to believe that tribes and environmental organizations, for example, have exactly parallel interests in a variety of environmental issues. And although there is often a very strong overlap between those two groups of people, it's not necessarily always exactly on par. And so keeping in mind, and not just assuming that if you have talked with some of the other interested stakeholders in a particular issue, that you're going to encapsulate the tribal view of what is going on in a particular case, I think is important to keep in mind. And the last thing I'll say before I hand it over to the next speaker is that every tribe is unique. We currently have somewhere in the neighborhood of 576 federally recognized tribes in the United States living somewhere in the, living on approximately 330 Indian reservations. We also have a host of state recognized tribes as well in the United States. And each of these tribes have their own history, their own relationship with the United States, their own relationship with the states and the local communities around them. And so in order to actually understand how a particular environmental issue is affecting the tribal people and Indian tribes, you have to specifically look at the tribes that are in that particular neighborhood, which is both an exciting opportunity to get to know new people, but is also a heavy responsibility for you as journalists, because that means that you'll have to build relationships with a different group of people depending on the case that you are working on. So I'll leave it there for now and hand it over to my co-panelists.
Thank you. Susan Jane.
Sure. I'm gonna try this without a microphone.
Oh, we need to. If you could use the microphone, because we're recording this.
Ah, okay. Online. Yes, is this on? Can you hear me? Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. My name is Susan Jane Brown. I am a senior staff attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center. I am based in Portland, Oregon, but I also split my time between the west side of the Cascades and the east side of the Cascades, and spend some time out in eastern Oregon in John Day. I'll talk a little bit about why that is, because it's a little odd. I have been with the Western Environmental Law Center for a number of years. My legal docket encapsulates a couple of different issues and areas, primarily though federal public lands issues. So anything that has to do with land management, critters, recreation, those kinds of things, anything that you might do on a national forest or land managed by the Bureau of Land Management, I have some familiarity and engagement with. My area of focus, though, is federal forest management and all the things that come up with that. So endangered species issues, wildfire issues, spend a lot of time on fire these days, both managed wildfire, prescribed fire, cultural burning, those kinds of things. I do also have an area of expertise with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. I am a planning nerd, and so I'm pretty familiar with how the NEPA process works for just sort of federal project planning, but also the land management planning processes that the Forest Service and BLM use. Spend a lot of time talking to planners. And then I also have a niche area of expertise with a little-known statute called the Oregon and California Lands Act of 1937. It is a it's an interesting statute. In my view, it's the first multiple use statute that Congress enacted. It only applies to the 2.6 million acres of forested BLM lands in western Oregon, however. So niche issue, but it's incredibly important locally and regionally in the Pacific Northwest. It's its own little ball of wax, and it has a lot of stakeholders that come with it, both from the counties that receive revenue from forest management on those lands, as well as the conservation community that kind of watchdogs that work going on there. So that's kind of my legal docket. I also engage in two other areas of focus that is possibly of interest to reporters and others. One is my federal policy docket. I spent a couple years working for Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democrat from Oregon, who now just recently retired. I was his natural resources counsel for a couple of years in Washington, D.C., and so picked up some federal policy expertise that way, and sort of in the same bucket of work that my legal practice focuses on. So natural resources, agriculture, organics, Native American affairs, those kinds of issues. And I continue on with that work, focusing currently on appropriations, because we're always talking about spending money. So the recently enacted Infrastructure Bill and Inflation Reduction Act, we call them Bill and IRA. So I do a lot of Bill and IRA implementation and drafting work, working with congressional offices and allies in the conservation community. Farm Bill is also, we do that every so often, at least Congress tries, and we're in Farm Bill season, so working on that, primarily looking at the forestry title of the Farm Bill, but also the conservation titles as well. And then finally, wildlife issues, wildfire issues. If Congress is dealing with that kind of stuff, I'll be in the mix on that. And then the other aspect of my work is collaboration. I spend a lot of time, and this is my Eastern Oregon connection, spend time with a diverse group of stakeholders in Eastern Oregon trying to come to agreement on large landscape forest restoration projects. And that has been a really interesting aspect of my work. It's not legal, it's people-based, it's relationship-based, and trying to close the gap in the areas of disagreement around federal forest management on the Malheur National Forest in Eastern Oregon. So in terms of, an attorney, I am an attorney, I spend time in the courtroom representing conservation organizations, but I also have these other areas of expertise, and that makes me a little bit unique. And that's one thing that I would offer to you all as reporters is, if you're looking for an attorney to demystify a recent court case, or why are these people suing yet again on these issues? Sometimes attorneys also have other areas of expertise that might be useful to you. And so although some of us are one-trick ponies, a lot of us aren't. And I think asking an attorney, I'm talking to you today about this particular case, is there anything else that you are familiar with that might be of interest to me? Sometimes attorneys have backgrounds in the hard or social sciences. And so, can you explain to me the biology of lynx and what's going on here and why that matters? Or can you explain, the latest climate change model and what I should take away from that? Ask your attorney contacts if they might have some other areas of expertise that they can demystify. I think Dylan gave a really great introduction, and a lot of the things that he's working on really resonated with me. In terms of the areas of work that I do, what's increasingly coming up is the overlap between federal public lands management and indigenous issues, Native American, federal Indian law, tribal law issues. The Biden administration has definitely made it a priority to elevate and center those voices. It's been a long time coming. There's a lot more that needs to be done. But it's an interesting time working in federal public lands law and issues because for a long time, and I would posit perhaps forever, we've really ignored indigenous voices and practices when it comes to federal laws and federal land management. And that's starting to change. And it's an interesting time. I'm still learning a whole lot about all of these issues pertaining to federal Indian law and tribal law. When I went to law school, I didn't have the opportunity to take those classes. And so I'm learning as well as a lot of folks are. But it's an interesting time. And I really appreciate Dylan's comment that just because you talk to a conservation organization, don't assume that that is the same position that the people who live and steward those lands, they may have a very different opinion. And so working in this field at this particular point in time is interesting, and it's ever-changing, and I like that challenge and am looking forward to embracing that as my work goes forward. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to my final co-panelists, and then hopefully we can have some questions and discussion.
All right. Thanks, Susan. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks, Dylan. Welcome, everyone. Good morning. It's great to be here. Appreciate the invitation to join all you journalists and others here. I guess as some of my co-panelists have noted, there's a lot of commonalities. I like to think that a lawyer's tools are his or her words, and I imagine it's the same in the journalism business. And as has already been mentioned, we may have more that binds us together than separates us. Hopefully we get to explore that a little more this morning. I'm Murray Feldman. I'm a partner in the Boise office of Holland & Hard. And one thing you may have picked up is Bobby and the organizers did a good job here of getting you a variety of three different types of lawyers in terms of broad areas of maybe not the subject matter of their practice, but how they practice. So we have someone who's in academia with Dylan. We have someone who's in the public interest sector and representing NGOs and others like that, and Susan, and I'm in private practice. So politely, when people ask, well, who do you represent, I try to say something like, well, the regulated community. So what does that translate to? Sometimes project developers, landowners, mining companies, pipeline companies, users of the public lands, but it's hard to draw a sharp box around it, because a lot of times it may be recreational use permittees like outfitters and guides. Sometimes it's also public interest groups. A lot of times it's local, regional, or state government entities, regional water providers. So even in private practice, I like to stress to people, there's still a lot of instances where you are working on matters or representing clients where there's a very strong public interest, because you may be representing a state, for instance, which has its public trust responsibilities, or some entity of the state, which has its public trust responsibilities for water resources or wildlife resources, depending on what the particular issue is. So even in one of the things that's pleased me over my career, to find out that even in private practice, there is a lot of opportunity to work on those public interest issues, and even arguably on the side of the public interest, although in many of these environmental cases, I think you'll see there's certainly public interest considerations on all sides of it, to the extent you may be able to say there's sides. So as far as background, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a forest ranger or park ranger. That's why I went to college. I thought I was going to be a forestry major, and then I figured out that was going to be a little too difficult, so I just majored in conservation of natural resources. But then I was graduating about the time the Reagan administration was just getting started, and that was not a great time to catch on with the Park Service or the Forest Service. So I did what anybody did at that time before higher education costs had spiraled, and I went to graduate school in forestry at the University of Idaho. And while there, wandered on campus over to where Dylan's now teaching and took some courses they had intended for non-lawyers and natural resource persons, and slowly got more interested in that, and then ended up deciding to go, say, the JD route instead of the PhD route. And so sometimes I think I still like to work for the Forest Service or the Park Service or something, but at least get to be in the room with them and on the email chains and working on some of the same issues. So that's, in terms of the background Susan was talking about, that's sort of how I found my way here. What I work on, I like how Bobby's referenced the alphabet soup, because at least in my work, we're striving now, and you get so many comments from judges, to use as few acronyms as possible.
So if I could file a brief that has like a table of acronyms and there's only six or something in it, I'm pretty excited. So I tend to spell out like, you know, National Environmental Policy Act or Endangered Species Act and try to eschew the acronyms. But those are two of the big statutory programs that I work in. FLTMA, Federal Land Policy and Management Act, as has been mentioned, is another, I don't know if we called it by name, but the National Forest Management Act. Another, also do work in the Clean Air Act areas, especially lately, a bizarre niche area of aftermarket defeat devices, which EPA has been clamping down on, say, for older diesel trucks, and a lot of folks want to fix them up, but a lot of that has been determined by EPA to be tampering and in violation of the anti-tampering provisions of the Clean Air Act. So I work in that area, which is just, in terms of trends you're watching, interesting in terms of the agency, the EPA's ratcheting down on tailpipe emissions now and trying to, you know, push that movement towards electric vehicles and all the implications that could have for where the battery component's going to come from and how's that going to work and where's the transmission capacity going to come from and the recharging capacity. And like, at least I think you see some people locally saying, it's like, well, when I can drive to Portland and back and not have to worry about recharging, that's when I'm going to get my electric vehicle. So in terms of trends I'm watching, that's one of them. Clean Water Act, end up not so much with the waters of the United States, me personally not working so much on jurisdictional waters issues, but just water quality considerations and discharge permits and a lot of stormwater permitting issues comes up, the type of clients I deal with. CERCLA, I tended to avoid for about... Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act, otherwise known as the Superfund statute. Good question. Which also helps explain why I was about to say, for like, until just recently, for the prior 25 years or so of my practice, I tried to avoid it because, much like Susan, I'm more of a, you know, critters, landscapes, wilderness, outdoor resources. Those are the type of issues I like to work on. But recently, I'm getting involved in another CERCLA matter, and it's not too bad so far. You know, one statute that I think implicates everything that the three of us on the panel are doing, but we haven't mentioned by name, is the National Historic Preservation Act, and especially with the increasing role of tribes and native interests and issues in environmental law issues, as both Susan and Dylan have mentioned. I find that's an important vehicle often where these issues come up, especially in federal project permitting. A lot of the times the tribes may intervene or are commenting and are participating. And even from the project applicant's perspective, a lot of the time you're having to consider those issues and working on programmatic agreements with the state historic preservation officer. Tribes may have input on that. They may often not join those programmatic agreements for various reasons, which we understand, but you still, as a project applicant or council, still may be working closely and meeting with and working with the tribes on those issues. And there's a whole subset of working with the tribes and having them on site at times when development activities are occurring, and working with tribal members to do project monitoring and clearing efforts for archaeological and cultural resource studies. So it's its own rich area that, as environmental lawyers, we stumble into and touch on at times. Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, we haven't mentioned. Another one, a lot of Wild and Scenic Rivers Act activity in Oregon, at least certainly in terms of legislative proposals recently. And items going on there. And actually, historically, I'd say in terms of Wild and Scenic Rivers Act implementation, there's been a, you know, series of cases in Oregon about grazing and designated areas and how those areas should be managed. So that's another statutory area I get involved in sometimes. And I think that's about it, other than really good panel yesterday for those of you that may have gone to it on FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act. Not an environmental statute, but certainly as environmental lawyers, I think we use that a lot on all sides to try to get information from the agencies both at the state and federal and local levels too, and to find out what's going on. And as I talked about at the beginning, in terms of having some public interest or government entity representations, even if it's not FOIA in the sense of I'm trying to draft a request and trying to get documents from someone, FOIA is often a concern, or the State Records Act analogs, often a concern to the types of folks we're working with, because as you're working on things, and it's always being shaped as, well, what's it going to look like if somebody makes a public records request for this? So you've got to be thinking about that and how you're characterizing things and how communication is flowing and what's in anticipation of litigation. And there's a lot of subsidiary issues there that are going on. So that's the overview of the alphabet soup and my background. I'd like to say, too, if it's appropriate now, just a few words about the lawyers interacting with journalists things, and I've run a few of these by Bobby in advance, and I'd say there's at least, you should recognize, like we talked about, the different types of lawyers and different focuses of practice and what they're doing, and recognizing, too, at least on my end of the telephone or the computer, because often sometimes the interview happens by email now or specific questions come in, that there's at least a couple of ways about it. I may be asked, that, as has been mentioned, sort of as the subject matter expert, you know, what do you think about this new public lands rule? Well, I may not have a client involved in it. I probably don't, because if I did, I probably wouldn't be commenting on it. And again, that's probably different with the different types of lawyer. Being in private practice, a lot of times I'm working with clients. They have their own government relations, public relations, external affairs, press relations people. They do not want me speaking on behalf of the company. I may receive inquiries from the press because people are getting the names off the court filings and all, and I am just routing those to the people I work with and say, do you want to respond to that person? And that's just the nature of the business at sort of those level of representations and who I represent. Personally, I think it would be pretty rare for any of those larger corporations to ever authorize me to speak on their behalf, other than, of course, you know, standing in court. That's the sort of the other way is that you're involved in a lawsuit as a litigant, as counsel for a litigant, and somebody wants to come up to you after the hearing or contact you after you file the brief and provide some comments. I do that sometimes, but that's usually when I'm involved in cases where I'm working more with the type of clients, for instance, that Susan may be working with more commonly. Environmental, non-governmental organizations, environmental groups, outdoor coalitions. Sometimes there's it's all attorney-client relationship, but it's a different type of relationship. And you're almost, at least I'll speak from my experience, you're almost more part of that group that you're representing. I mean, not technically, if there's still those distinctions, but you're more aligned with them in a way that you just sort of have a certain level of trust and confidence that they're like, hey, yeah, if you have an opportunity to talk to a reporter or even sometimes to drive coverage, you know, in my youth, I've been known to just sort of type up a press release and fax it out when that was the thing to do back in the days, and then, you know, the reporters would call, and the next day the group I was working with and the story about their case was in the newspaper, back when we had newspapers in stands on the street. So just know that there's different types of lawyers, different types of interviews, and different ways to interact with them, and different ability to get information that way. Back to you.
Thanks, Murray. So we're going to do a little bit of a discussion here, and then we'll open it up to you guys for questions. And I want to reserve about 25 minutes or so for that. But just to start out, I'm wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about how the environmental and tribal legal landscape has shifted over the last 5 or 6 years since the beginning of the Trump administration. And of course, the Trump administration had its deregulatory agenda that, you know, in some ways got pretty far along, and the Biden administration has responded to that, and there's been a cascade of lawsuits, you know, affecting both. So what are you guys seeing out there, and how's the legal landscape shifted? And Dylan, let's start with you.
Well, sure. Thanks. So I'll talk specifically about how the landscape has shifted as far as relations between tribes and the executive branch. I'll leave it to Murray and Susan to talk a little bit more about the regulatory situation. The way I would classify this is, the word that comes to mind when I think about the Obama administration to the Trump administration to the Biden administration is whipsaw. The Obama administration, in my view, was very responsive up until the Biden administration, probably the most responsive administration to tribes and tribal interests, you know, in the last, 30 to, 50 years. For example, they the White House hosted the first tribal summit, I believe, since the Nixon administration during the Obama administration. And as a result of that and the work that they were doing, tribes, were heard and had a pretty strong role within the federal government during that time and were able to affect federal policy. That largely went away for 4 years during the Trump administration. My experience with working with people within the federal family at the sort of staff and permanent level within Department of Justice, Department of Interior was legal positions largely remain the same, at least in the work that I did. But at the political level, the Trump administration was not advancing a lot of legislation or policies within the executive branch that were supportive of tribes and tribal interests. And then once we get to the Biden administration, I would classify what the Biden administration has done as a quantum leap in tribal-federal relations. The Biden administration just recently had yet another tribal summit where they hosted tribes from all over the country to talk specifically about issues important to tribes. There is a tribal representative within the Biden administration's inner circle of policymakers that reports directly to Susan Rice at the White House. We have political appointees at the highest levels that are members of tribes. We have Secretary Deb Haaland, who is Secretary of the Interior, first indigenous person to hold that post. We have Charles Sams as Director of the Park Service from Umatilla Tribe in Oregon. And then we also have Bob Anderson, who's the solicitor for the Department of the Interior, longtime law professor at the University of Washington, a Chippewa tribal member. And so we have indigenous people within the federal family that have a unique role in how our public lands are being managed, which I think is a pretty important and significant step forward.
So I just want to ask you there. Just want to briefly ask you about that. What effect is that? What material effect has that had so far on public lands management that you've seen?
I think that the big one was, the biggest one has been that really early on in the administration. Well, so two things. One, there's been a moratorium for the last 40 plus years on tribes developing tribal water management codes. And that has recently been lifted, and so tribes now are able to better manage water resources within their reservations. So that was a big one. But I think for public lands, the secretaries of agriculture and the secretaries of interior recently issued an interagency order directing all of their agencies to enter into co-management, co-stewardship plans with tribes when the federal agencies are working on landscapes where tribal interests are uniquely affected. And so it's to be determined how that shakes out. It's something that we've been talking, that tribal, you know, the tribes have been talking about it. It was a point. I was on a panel just last week in Albuquerque at the Federal Bar Association's Indian Law Conference, where we were talking about that very thing. But the tangible result of that is that we're moving, I think, beyond consulting with tribes on issues related to federal lands to providing opportunities for tribal people to actively be land managers alongside with the federal agencies in areas that they have really strong ties to. And so I think that's a really big leap.
Thank you. So Susan and Murray, shifting legal landscape over the last few years, what's your take on that?
I would agree with with Dylan on this administration's focus on tribal co-management. The joint secretarial order that he mentioned, 3403, is fascinating. It's a really interesting blueprint for how this administration views the federal government's trust obligations to Native American tribes and Alaska Natives as well, which is a whole another distinct area of law and has its own kind of issues and challenges, also opportunities. And so I think that has been a real shift, and I think it will be interesting to see what this administration is able to do and to actually put into place durable policies, hopefully laws, if we can get Congress to be functional. I don't know about that, but at least policies coming from the executive branch, because, again, way overdue, and I think that if we're able to cement some of those policies, for example, in federal land management, co-management and co-stewardship are a very different way of looking at federal land managers and management. And I think that that will, if it manages to stick around, I think that will be a big issue and again, a leap forward. What's interesting about that too, though, is this idea of the non-delegation doctrine, which is, this is where the rubber meets the road. So if we agree that tribes should be or should be allowed to co-manage federal public lands along with federal land managers, how do we actually do that? How do you effectuate that? What kinds of agreements need to be in place, contracts or memorandum or of agreement or understandings? What does that actually mean, and how does that bind the federal government, and what does that relationship look like? Because in my experience, tribal consultation between the federal government and tribes has not been an authentic process. It's often viewed by both federal land managers and tribes as a check-the-box kind of exercise, and there's not authentic engagement in terms of what does the tribe really actually want to see done here in this project or on this landscape, as opposed to the federal government coming in and saying, well, we've made a decision. Here's what it is, hope you like it. And so co-management and the vision that is put forward in the joint secretarial order is something very different from that. But then how do we actually do that? And what does that look like on the ground for a reporter or a stakeholder or a government? And that's to be seen and to be determined. So I think that is a growing area. It's complicated and it's really technical and legalese. And frankly, it's an unsettled area of law, and that area of law in terms of the non-delegation doctrine is evolving. And so when you're looking for information or to understand what this is or what this new agreement means for a local area, you may not actually get hard and fast answers from attorneys that you consult, because we may not know. So uncertainty, exciting uncertainty in my view, so we'll have to see where that goes.
Great.
Thanks, Susan. On the tribal issues and how things have transitioned, I think Dylan and Susan have covered that nicely. I will add on the delegation points Susan was talking about. I see that too. It's coming up For instance, in the water rights adjudication in the Flathead Basin in Montana, where there's been a compact between the states, the federal government, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes there, which at least at some level appears to give a lot of the water rights administration and management responsibility to either tribal entities or entities that were created in the compact that have a majority tribal representation. I think that's probably going to get hashed out in some ongoing litigation there. So there are some interesting implementation issues. I will say from the long view, I think Dylan and Susan are doing a good job of identifying some more recent things that are happening. From my longer view perspective, I'd say even on issues I was involved in the early and mid-90s, there was always some tribal role or input, and it may have been more of the type of government-to-government consultation you're talking about, but I recall critical habitat designation issues in the Upper Salmon watershed in the mid-90s, where the tribes were very involved in commenting and wanting to have their input known there. Obviously, the Snake River Basin adjudication, which went on for a long time, but started there in the 90s, in that time period, and the Nez Perce and other tribes in Idaho, a huge role in that, in both in terms of some of the issues being resolved before the final decree and some of the water rights settlements were reached, and also a role in those settlements. With some of the clients I dealt with, tribal employment rights ordinances were an issue, and I think still remain an issue. So there's, I just want to paint the picture that it's not suddenly the tribal interests and acknowledgments are springing up, but there's been a long history of that, and it's evolved to this point now where maybe the foundation was there for that quantum leap that Dylan described.
So we're running a little low on time, but I've got one other question that to clarify some things before we turn it over to the audience. And Dylan, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between federal law and tribal law, and how you're seeing or how you expect the Supreme Court to approach that.
Well, I'd be loath to get under that hood too much, but I can't explain the difference between the two concepts. And I think that it highlights an important thing that is different about tribes compared to other groups, which is that tribes, since the beginning of the United States, and indeed even before then, were recognized as being sovereigns. And as a result of that, the Supreme Court and our government has long recognized that tribes have the right to make their own laws and be ruled by them, which is unique in our constitutional system. And so, for example, when I was taught U.S. government, I was taught U.S. government as the classic federalism model is that we're balancing power between two groups of sovereigns, states and the United States, when in actuality we're talking about three different groups of sovereigns within the United States, states, the United States, and tribes. That's not to say that their sovereignty is exactly the same as a sovereign state, lowercase s, like a foreign state, or even states of the union. The Supreme Court has long said that tribal sovereignty is subject to the overarching authority of the Congress of the United States, and so Congress can circumscribe tribal sovereignty and limit it. But subject to that, tribes are tend to have broad lawmaking authority. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about tribal law. Tribal law are the laws that are made by each individual tribe through their legislative branch and are enforced through their executive and judicial branches. And that's not to be confused with the area that I primarily practice in, which is referred to as federal Indian law, which deals with the relationship, the government-to-government relationship between tribes, the United States, and to a lesser but growing extent, states. And so those are the two different fields. And I know time is of the essence, but the last point I want to make about this is that every tribe's, what makes this complex and difficult but also exciting is that every tribe has its own set of laws. And there may be a lot of overlap in particular issues, but by and large, in order to understand what the tribal law is of a particular tribe, you're going to have to go and research that particular tribe's laws. Just like Washington state law is somewhat different from Idaho state law, Nez Perce tribal law is somewhat different from Coeur d'Alene tribal law. So understanding those distinctions and being able to find people that can help you to understand those distinctions becomes really important.
Thank you. All right, so I'm going to take questions from you guys. As an SEJ rule, SEJ and journalism group members ask questions first, and please identify yourself when you ask a question. But this is being recorded, so I'm going to have to give you my microphone, and we'll have to swap microphones a bit. So, questions.
Hi, thank you for the panel. So my name is James Gaines. I'm a freelance reporter from Seattle. So my question would be, if I am at the point where I'm looking for news stories to report on, and I'm reaching out to you saying something like, I have some general questions and some general interests, but not a specific thing I'm already working on, I'm hoping to generate some leads for me to pursue, what would be the best way, or is there a particular approach to talking to you or a particular approach to that conversation that you think would be most productive?
Good question. So I think I get cold calls pretty frequently because I am a subject matter expert on a number of issues. I like spotted owls, for example, do a lot of spotted owl litigation. So I get calls about what's going on with spotted owls. And yesterday I actually spoke to a reporter from The Guardian in Canada who wanted to talk about their spotted owl issues. They have two left in the wild, and we have a few more than that in the States, but not that many. And so I'll often get, you know, what you're saying. It's like, I'm interested in writing on this issue. Here's what I know. What's coming up for you in your practice? How are you seeing this issue show up? And that will often, you know, go down a particular trajectory, because if you're talking to me as someone who represents conservation organizations, I'm going to give you my sort of view of the world. If you call an attorney who represents the timber industry, they're going to give you a different, you know, point of view. And so I will often get asked by reporters, you know, thanks for the conversation we had. Who else do you think I should talk to? So it's sort of that popcorning type of approach. And I think that that usually gets folks, gets reporters what they're looking for, both a balanced perspective, but then also leads that they can go down that rabbit hole if that's where you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anybody else? All right, so questions?
Maybe I can jump in just really fast. And I really appreciate the question because it actually leads to a point that I wanted to emphasize, which is that when you're talking about trying to report on issues in tribal communities, oftentimes tribes want, kind of like what Murray was saying, tribes like to speak for themselves. And so they don't necessarily want their lawyers out in front. And also lawyers will give you sort of their, like I think Susan was just sort of talking about, lawyers will talk about this from a legal perspective, but oftentimes, and this is changing as we increase the number of Native lawyers that we have in the profession, but oftentimes the people that are representing tribes don't necessarily have the perspective that tribes do about why these different issues are important. And so I would encourage everyone, if you're reporting on Indian country, to go and talk to the tribal leadership themselves. But what that requires is relationships. Tribes are also reluctant to just sort of talk to whoever. From the perspective of a journalist trying to sort of break into that community and have sources that will help you to understand kind of what is on the horizon. I think that what that requires is longer lasting and more durable relationships. And so doing things like participating in community events to the extent that you can in the region that you live in, getting to know people within that community and taking advantage of different ways of sort of integrating yourself into those communities becomes a really important part of the business. And so that way, when you start to have those discussions about, I have this nascent idea, you'll have people that are going to be able to help you sort of develop those stories.
So that's a very interesting point. In my coverage, I cover public lands and some tribal issues nationwide, from Florida to Alaska. What advice would you give for reporters who aren't necessarily embedded in a specific community, who would like to develop those tribal sources in, you know, widespread places like that? And knowing that, at least in my experience, it's always best to be there in person rather than just make cold calls.
Yeah, I think in that case, you kind of have to do the best you can. And so you can rely on the relationships that you do have. I mean, there are people within the Indian legal community that have relationships across the United States. And so knowing those people and having relationships with those people, having someone that's willing to vouch for you, it will go a long ways, you know, and so then you can start to build those relationships. But the one thing that I think is important, and this doesn't really bother me as much because, you know, I'm sort of in this business, but when you're talking about working with tribal people, just sort of extracting information and then sort of disappearing from the community is not something that tribal folks tend to appreciate. So once you have a connection to a particular community, sort of doing what you can to cultivate it and demonstrating that what you've done to be beneficial for that community through your reporting and those sorts of things, I think becomes really important as well. But I think ultimately for people that are national in scope, you need to have sort of folks that are willing, that have relationships that are also national in scope, that are, you know, willing to vouch for you as a person that is going to do a rigorous job of reporting.
Thank you. Questions? Back here.
Hi, I'm Ariel Samuelson. I report for Keaton. Murray, you mentioned earlier that sometimes journalists will call you and ask you about a case, but you can't really speak to it. So I was wondering, and this can be a question for all of you, if you want to report on a specific case or a specific law firm, what is your suggestion to journalists who want to, you know, actually talk to the lawyers involved? Or do you always have to go outside the folks involved?
Well, I'll start. Again, it depends on the particular case and situation and, you know, for me, the particular relationship I have with a client. And sometimes they'll authorize me to talk to a reporter, but other times not, and I have to honor that. And then there is always opportunity to talk on background, if it's just to, you know, describe what's happening or what does this filing mean or what's coming next. There's that. But and I don't like to just tell people no. You know, I say, well, I can't talk to you, but here's the person you can contact, or I forwarded your inquiry to this person at the company, and you could get in contact with them. And a lot of times, recognize too, in the types of things I'm working on, there's at least two layers of lawyers representing the client or the company or whoever the ultimate client is. There's me as outside counsel, and then there's the lawyer's own inside counsel. And sometimes when I say they don't want me to speak for them, it's like they don't want their outside counsel speaking for them. But their in-house counsel, who may also be, you know, the vice president and general counsel of the company, they may be more free and more willing to speak. So there's usually some avenues, I think, to help the journalists get the information they want. And when I said I can't talk in some of the situations, I didn't mean I'm just giving people a hard no, go away. It's like, I can't speak to you on the record, but let me help you find someone who can.
Thanks. Questions?
Back here.
Good morning. I'm Andy McGlash, and I'm with Audubon Magazine. I'm wondering if anyone on the panel or Bobby has ideas for like clinics or workshops or ways that journalists can learn more, go a little deeper on environmental law in like 2 days instead of 2 years, kind of thing.
So there are a couple avenues for you. Here in the Pacific Northwest, there's the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, known as PILC, or for old timers like me, ELAW. And that conference is at the University of Oregon's School of Law every March, usually the first week in March. And that's a really good way to dive in head first into environmental law issues, because it's a weekend conference. It's like three and a half days, where it's a student organized and run conference, but it's also attended by environmental attorneys and lots of panels on, you know, current litigation or, you know, Endangered Species Act year in review. So you get an overview of all the cases that have come up over the past year. And it also gives you a really great opportunity to network with those attorneys who are involved in those cases or those issues, as well as their clients. So my clients go to that conference. I go to that conference. All of the environmental attorneys I know go to that conference. And so it's definitely a nerd fest, but I think that's a really great way to get an overview and a smattering of kind of what's going on. There are also, all lawyers have to take continuing legal education classes. We have to report to our state bars every 3 years to make sure that we're still ethical and competent, all that kind of good stuff. And most state bars do have environmental law year in review CLEs that are open to the public. You don't have to be a lawyer. And you'll get, you know, here's your review of, you know, Resource Conservation Recovery Act. Oh, yes, I got it. You know, here's what's been going on in the NEPA world, for example. So that's also a good way, I think, to get an overview. They can be really weedy and nerdy, and you'll get all kinds of sections of code quoted at you and all that kind of good stuff. But there's also materials that are usually part of those CLEs. So you'll get some paper that you can, or digital, that you can take home and use as a really good resource on some of this stuff. So those are a couple of suggestions I would have for you.
Also, there's the Environmental Law Institute. They occasionally do seminars that journalists can join. I think the Vermont Law School has something as well, if I recall. When I started at Bloomberg 5.5 years ago, I didn't cover legal issues, and nobody on our desk did. So it's been a little bit of a trial by fire for me. About 3 years ago, we shifted our focus to environmental law, and I just started calling lots of lawyers and talking to them, and reading lots of lawsuits. And
Bobby,
eventually I'll be able to. Go ahead.
Oh, I just had a few more suggestions. That was a good question. In addition to ELI that Bobby mentioned, there's the Foundation for Natural Resources and Energy Law. They welcome journalists and media members at their annual institute and others, so you could probably attend without having to pay the exorbitant fees even, and then get a bunch of presentations by lawyers like Susan was describing. Then also there's a lot of law schools that have sort of centers on law and the environment. So there's one at UC Berkeley called CLE, the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. There's the Wilkinson Center at the University of Colorado. I know there's some, I don't know if it's City College of New York or some of the New York law schools that focus especially on climate change issues and have huge databases of climate change litigation. But it's not just the resources they have online. A lot of times they're having webinars and seminars and programs that are open to everyone, not just lawyers. So that might be a good resource.
Great, thanks. Questions?
Just two more, Bobby, sorry.
Oh.
Specifically on the Indian law side, I was going to suggest have Ben Ariel as well. So I'm glad Murray plucked that one. But on the Indian law side, both Lewis and Clark Law School, as well as the University of Montana, offer summer programs in Indian law, and every year that includes issues where environmental law and Native American law intersect, and so that would also be a good place to look.
Great, thanks. Questions? Dylan, could you repeat what you just said? Which institutes were you talking about?
The last two. Clark Law School in Portland, and then the University of Montana in Missoula, both have summer programs, and they're they're not 2-day courses. They're short courses, so they're usually, I think, a week long, really intensive courses on the federal Indian law in a variety of different aspects.
Great. Any more questions?
If we're done with journalists, I've got a quick one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Aaron Weiss with the Center for Western Priorities, and a former journalist and now journalism adjacent. What questions are reporters not asking you that they should be when they call you up?
That's a great question.
That's a really good question. I think that oftentimes a lot of the questions I get are very specific to the story that the reporter's writing, or they're looking for background and just kind of want to get grounded in a subject matter or an issue or whatever. But I think there's not a lot of questions about how litigation affects people. We're up here filing briefs and standing up in court and talking to judges and all that kind of good stuff, but litigation affects people on the ground. And, you know, I'm trying to save forests and trees and critters and all that kind of good stuff, but, and through my collaborative work, I'm very well aware of how litigation can affect local communities and everyday people, whether that's the logger that, you know, wants to make a living, or the wildlife biologist that likes to survey for owls, or whatever it happens to be. And I think that that sort of human aspect of litigation and the policy debates that we, you know, engage in, I think that's really missing, and it's important. And I think that talking about that is something that gets overlooked. I also think that, and this is, as reporters, you know this, that, you know, the conflict sells, and there's not a whole lot of focus on solutions and where agreement has been reached, and how that is different than focusing on the disagreement. Disagreement's fine, but focusing on how we can overcome disagreement, I think, is really, really important in today's very, very polarized society.
Just quickly, we've got 5 minutes.
I would frame the question as how will this ultimately get resolved?
Yeah.
And that on a lot of the issues we're talking about, like federal lands management, National Environmental Policy Act, the ultimate answer is never going to come from the court. That's just maybe going to reset the playing field or the debate. So trying to look at the long view, say ultimately, how does it get resolved?
Dylan?
Just a plus one to what Susan said about focusing on conflict versus solutions. There's a lot of really amazing work that's going on around the country, and particularly around the West, in my field, in water resources resiliency that is not really being talked about. And it creates this myth that everything around water is about conflict, whereas communities and in my world, tribal communities in particular, are doing a lot with the people around them to build resilience and address the unique issues that are being confronted with. And I think addressing those and highlighting those would go a long ways towards sort of dispelling this myth that water in particular is a zero sum game, and the only way that we're going to resolve this is through continued conflict.
So I want to close with one last question for you guys. And if you could think of one case that you're following that will affect people the most on the ground, what would it be?
Sure, Will.
Well, so for tribal people, it's not an environmental case. It's this Brackeen versus Holland case, which is a case involving the Indian Child Welfare
Act. I'm sorry, could you say that again? Which case was that?
Brackeen versus Holland, as in Secretary Holland. And it's a case that's currently pending in the United States Supreme Court involving the Indian Child Welfare Act, but the Brackeens have levied a whole host of challenges to the Indian Child Welfare Act, one of which being, you know, legislating in the field of federal Indian law violates equal protection because it's impermissibly race-based, which misunderstands the political relationship that tribes have with the United States. But it's being taken up in a term where the Supreme Court is also looking at things like affirmative action, and so it very well could end up undermining the field of federal Indian law and a whole host of laws, including environmental laws, that treat tribes differently. Really quickly, the other one that I've been working on is Arizona versus Navajo Nation, which deals with the scope of the federal trust responsibility, specifically in water resources. And that, I think, is interesting because it has to do with, at one level, you know, how are we going to continue to manage the Colorado River Basin, which is already well over appropriated, but there's a bunch of unquantified rights that are held or that are owned by Indian tribes, and how that management is going to take place. But the bigger question is just, what is the relationship between the United States and tribes going to look like moving forward? And is the trust responsibility really a true responsibility on the part of the United States, or is it really just another way that the United States can go about sort of appropriating tribal rights, lands, and resources with no real responsibility on the federal end?
So we've got less.
Those are the two I'm looking at right now. Sorry.
We've got less than 2 minutes left. Murray, 30 seconds.
Colorado River management that Dylan mentioned and the secretary mentioned yesterday, it implicates tribal rights, endangered species issues, hydropower production, recreation, just the whole suite of everything we've been talking about.
I'm actually watching administrative law issues in the Supreme Court, so the major questions doctrine and the fate of Chevron, which is a Supreme Court case from many years ago, and how far Congress has to go to, and how specific they need to be before a federal agency can actually do its job. So particularly interested in that, and because we deal with a lot of federal agencies with land management.
All right. Thank you guys very much. Thank you for coming.